in Gimsan, 24/11/65. While setting up the tape, he made a remark about being unpopular with the planters in 1940-41, just before he left for Hong Kong. And this brought on the question of the trade unions, Indian immigration, and the Indian government's attitude. Apparently, because the Indian government barred those long resident in Ceylon from returning to India, any immigrants who were dismissed found themselves in a stateless position. And this had repercussions on trade unions and relations between immigrants and planters.
To Ceylon.
Mm-hmm.
And I differed, actually. I was actually fighting a lone battle. And I regarded this as being deeply responsible for all the trouble in Ceylon. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't get anyone else to agree with me that the matter was worthwhile taking up. You see, they had this man Jackson. He'd been Attorney General and Legal Secretary. He came out and to inquire into this problem of immigration.
St. John Jackson?
That's the one. He came out to inquire into this trouble. He published a report, and the theme of his report was that there was no need for any restrictions, because when Indian labour was wanted in Ceylon, and there was a full circle of employment, they came to Ceylon. When they weren't wanted in Ceylon, there was unemployment in Ceylon, they went back. Oh, come in, Jason. Oh, thank you very much. I reacted with Jackson's report because he criticized the Sigleys for their inability to attune themselves to other forms of employment than working on the field.
In the fields. And what do you think of Jackson's views?
I thought Jackson's views were correct.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't get anyone to believe in it.
And
I was saying before, the Sinclair's peasant is a very independent person. Mm-hmm. Peasants always are. And you couldn't expect him to go on to an estate to be subject to the discipline of a very strict labour force.
Yes, I see.
They won't. They are peasants. I mean, after all, it's very disciplined work on a tea estate. And you could never expect the Sinclair's active to attune themselves to that particular form of labour.
Mm-hmm. And what about this Indian government standpoint? This is in the 1930s.
This was in the 1937, I think.
37.
Yes.
And what do you think of their views?
I thought their views were being stupid. They were really most unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a result of their attitude, as the result of the prevention of this ebb and flow of labour, which Jackson said took place.
Mm-hmm. The labourer was in a spot.
The labourer on the spot, and he became stabilised. The Indian labour became stabilised on the Ceylon estate.
Mm. And the Ceylonese trade unions took this up as such. I mean.
Well, Philip Gunawardene and Nenem Pereira, they took the matter up.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, the one reason why they took the matter up, another reason, of course, one reason why they took the matter up was because all these people had the vote.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if they hadn't had the vote, it wouldn't have become a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it made actually the development of trade unions extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And it prejudiced actually our development as in this country.
What did they demand and what did they ask for?
Well, the chief, as I said, the chief thing they demanded in my day was the question with regard to the question of dismissal.
What did they want specifically?
Well, I suppose that was practically the only demand they made. If a man was dismissed, then they went up in arms.
Mm-hmm.
You see. That was the, and we made a some sort of agreement actually with the between the planters and the trade unions with regard to the procedure with regard to the dismissal, but it didn't work very, very satisfactorily. It was a wonderful agreement, of course.
Both sides are a bit recalcitrant, were they?
Yes. And another thing too, you see, I differed very, very strongly from the trade union, from the planters. Because I regarded the agitation among the planters, among the labour force, as being signs of nationalism. You see. It was a nationalist way which was spreading among the coolies. And this wave of nationalism is something which is very, very difficult to define. It's more of an emotion than anything else, you see. And I considered that that you had to take in account that it was actually something which was felt by all the labour force. And it wasn't just the responsibility of individual agitators.
Mm-hmm.
I was very impressed. I don't know, but is this interesting?
Oh yes, very interesting.
Well, I was very impressed by a man called Sir Harold Butler, who came to Ceylon. He was Director General of the International Labour Office.
Mm-hmm.
And he visited Ceylon when I was there. And he wrote his report afterwards of his visit to Asia and the Far East. He didn't go to China. I don't think he went to Japan. But anyway, he went to Indonesia, Ceylon, Malaya, and he said, I think he was probably right. He said that when the history of the 20th century comes to Britain, this was interesting, when the history of the 20th century comes to Britain, the most significant feature will not be the rise of Hitler and Mussolini, but the rise of nationalism in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1907. That was the result of the report. Well, he was Director General of International Labour.
Yes, I see.
And I was very, very impressed by that. And perhaps, I don't know, I'm perhaps prepared to admit, I was perhaps too impressed by it.
Mm-hmm.
And attached too much importance to it, but it was all the basis of my attitude in the labour.
Were the planters very extreme in their views? I mean, they were totally against trade unions, were they?
Well, the trouble with the planters, I think, was that they weren't their own masters.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they were dependent. A large number of them were dependent on the board of directors in London. And the board of directors in London were mostly composed of people who had been out in Ceylon years before, when there had been no trouble of any kind. You see. And they thought if one of their superintendents was not controlling his labour properly, that he was a bad superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't the sympathy, therefore, of the people in London. And they were very terrified, actually, of their insecurity in the face of this trouble in London.
Would you say that this policy emanating from London was, in a sense, reactionary?
Well, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Very reactionary. Now, what was I going to say? Well, yes, another message. Well, I was so worried about this, I couldn't get the farmers to agree on my end. I asked them to appoint a commission to inquire from their own angle, to inquire into this question of labour. And we got one planter called Wilfred Retty, with whom I discussed the matter quite well. He agreed with me, he read this report of Batra. And also a man called Luddington, who was in the civil service. I don't know what happened to him before he died. He had been a controller of labor before me, and there was some other guy. Anyway, they were quite prepared, actually, to undertake this investigation. The people in the Song Association in London, who were, as I said, chiefly composed of people who'd been in Islam before, didn't have anything to do with men never met.
So it was only a few who were reasonable.
Only a few who were
in Ceylon. What were the conditions of labor as such? The master-servant law aspect.
Well, of course, the criminal provisions of the labor code had been abolished, of course. You know, that had been abolished some time before.
Mm-hmm.
What were you mean exactly?
I mean, the laws were up to date, were they? The laborers weren't at any disadvantage as such.
No, I don't think they were on the whole. One of the troubles was, of course, in the Ceylon was the Kangani system.
Mm-hmm. It's always been.
Well, the planters actually believed in the Kangani system, and any suggestion that it was a handicap to the development of labor relations was
They did believe in it, did they? Because in the 19th century you get criticism from the planters of the Kangani system because they lost some of their advances. But they tried to reform this. The government did,
yes.
and the planters too. But it was just retained, and one of the arguments was that the coolie would have his Kangani and that the coolies wouldn't do with the Kangani. So it's rather change state of affairs.
Yes. Well, certainly I remember because in one of my annual reports, I mentioned the fact that the Kangani system must go, and they went right off the deep end of it. Now, when I was in Singapore, I came there with a definite notion, you see, of the idea that the Kangani system was a handicap to the development of labor relations and happy approach from the employer to the employee. But I realized actually the Kangani system, as you were saying, if you weren't together, did perform a useful service in that it gave advances, you say,
mm-hmm.
and if they were ill, it gave them money to tide over the illness and that sort of thing. Well, I said to a man in the harbour in Singapore, I said, if you want to abolish that, the Kangani system, they didn't call it the Kangani system, but the next one, you must have some substitute in the place of the Kangani who will be able to provide means for them when they want advances and things like that. And he said, yes, he did. He quite appreciated that. And I don't know what he did in a minute, but he abolished the Kangani system, and he must have substituted something in his place because, as a result of that, the relations between the employers and the employees were very, very much happier.
I see. And were these coolies badly indebted to the Kangani?
I think they were very, very indebted.
But they couldn't find out how much, and you couldn't check this.
Well, I never did it myself.
Mm-hmm. What sort of influence did the Minister of Labour, was there a Minister of Labour?
Oh, Collier, yes, he was excellent.
Oh, I see.
I was entire sympathy. Well, I wouldn't say he was entire. I was entire sympathy with him.
Because
he was in sympathy.
He was, in effect, your superior boss.
He dictated the policy.
Oh, I see.
But his policy and my policy, I mean, were quite the same.
Quite the same. Yeah. It was on your advice that.
I think it was our mutual.
Yes, I see. But you were in a position of a permanent undersecretary.
That's right. Yeah. Mm.
And. I asked about the labor laws because Colonel Wright in his book says that, the labor laws did, quote, no justice to the employer.
I wouldn't say that for a moment.
Yes, it seems a rather...
Yeah, I wouldn't say that for a moment.
Patently selfish point of view. And in effect, I would say that it gives a lie to their contention that trade unions were not called for.
Yeah. Ah, definitely, I quite agree. The trade unions will definitely call for it.
And what sort of pressure did the planters bring to bear in 1940-1941?
In what way do you mean?
You said that you were unpopular among the planters.
I got on so well with you, and I also had the entire sympathy of the government that they didn't bring any pressure to bear, though they were talk at one time making representations to the government having their own move.
Oh, I see. They did talk about it. Now I was wondering whether they were in social talk and remarks in the club and so on and so forth.
Oh, I should think the remarks in the club were ghastly. I remember going into one club when they turned their backs on me.
Oh, in Candy, was it?
No, this wasn't in Candy. This was in Delaware, I know.
Oh, yes, I know. It's one of the ragga places.
Yeah.
But
they couldn't have had any influence because I had the confidence not only of the minister but the governor of the colonial office too. Otherwise, they wouldn't have got.
They disliked Sir Andrew Caldicott because of this, did they?
They thought he might have taken stronger action. Mm-hmm. But there was no question of taking action. I mean, you can't dismiss the whole of the Labour force. They had to face the fact that the government definitely were keen on fostering the development of the trade unions. And another thing which happened, as a matter of fact, is this. Before I became controller of Labour, the controller was very much under the thumb of the plant.
Yes, I see. This was in the 1920s.
So this was later, in the early 1930s,
mm-hmm.
until I came along on the scene.
Oh, I see.
And then I regarded myself in a different capacity. I regarded myself as the protagonist of the Labour,
mm-hmm.
you see. And when I went to visit Sir Ceylon on my return from Malaya in 1952, I called on the Labour office. Some clerks were still there, remembered me. And the senior one said to me, he said, well, you put the Labour, you always regard it as having put the Labour Department on its feet. I made it
independent of the planters.
Independent of the planters.
I see.
That's my own view entirely, of course.
If I may go back in time to the 1920s when you had arrived, and well, of course, you were not in charge of the Labour Department. There were some changes in this conditions of immigrant labour in the 1920s. There was a commission, wasn't it?
Yes, I remember that was. I think the point about that was that the Indian government. I don't know very much about this myself, but the Indian government, as far as I know, had laid down certain conditions with regard to the immigration of labour to Ceylon and the employment of Indian labour in Ceylon.
Mm-hmm.
When I say Ceylon, I shouldn't have. As a matter of fact, they were very excited in India about that time, about the treatment of Indians overseas.
Malaya?
The West Indies?
Yes.
Africa?
Mauritius.
It was on Fiji. It was always a cry which appealed to the politicians in India, and the government very often raised this cry when they wanted to divert attention from some internal trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they made a lot of regulations with regard to Indian labour, and the result of that, certain regulations had to be formulated in Ceylon. And the controller of labour, he was called the controller of Indian immigrant labour.
Established.
And it also affected, actually, there were, in South India, there was a Ceylon Immigration Commission who had to be appointed in South India.
Well, this commission was a labour recruiting agency, was it?
Yes, labour recruiting agency.
Well, Colonel Wright again says that before government took it over, the planters ran it better.
Well, that wasn't... I wouldn't say that because I didn't know. But I shouldn't have thought so.
Yes.
When I was there, it was very well run indeed.
Well, I should think that he means that the planters ran it better from their own point of view.
Yes, probably.
Regarding 1937 again, this Indian viewpoint, do you think it was the policy of the Indian politicians as such, or did British administrators in India have any hand in it?
I don't know, but it's only my opinion, but I should think it was very much on the part of the politicians.
Mm-hmm. And what about the trade unions, the estate trade unions in Ceylon? Do you think it was marred by political purposes and political intrigues at that time? Another difficult question.
I should have said no.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really take as much advantage, actually, of the situation. The politicians didn't take as much advantage of the situation as they might have done. But, you see, the difficulty was with the trade unions, there were no employees themselves, no members of the trade union, no employees themselves who are really educated enough to give the leadership to the trade unions to develop.
So it had to automatically be the
politicians, people from outside. They didn't actually give as much attention, I think, to the development of the trade unions as they might have done. There was Natisa Iyer, I suppose you know him by name. Natisa Iyer.
Yes, I heard him.
Well, he was the one who apparently, who was, the planters hated him, of course. He was, and I always found him very reasonable.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of Enyam Pereira and Philip Gunawardena?
He's only my person. I liked them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were sincere. I think they were sincere nationalists myself. I'm sorry they have developed in the way they've done, but possibly. But I liked them, and I think they, looking back on it now, I think they really had a sincere point of view.
Mm-hmm.
They were inexperienced, of course, and they hadn't really much knowledge of trade union development, but we found, after dealing with them, that they were prepared. I had a lot of dealings with them, of course, until they were shut up. But I always found they would react actually to an argument. And I think I captured, to a certain extent, their confidence. And I always found it very pleasant, and I'd always be glad to meet them again.
Yes. What was, turning to the political field, what was the government attitude to the LSSP party as such?
Oh, I should say. Well, because they locked them up.
That was in 1941.
Yeah, that's
why?
Well, because... I had nothing to do with it.
Yes, of course.
But it was entirely a police matter. But from my point of view, they were accused actually of fostering disorder on estates.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly was certainly that was coming about, and I think for that reason they were locked up. Definitely after they were locked up, things on the States were very, very much quieter.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And would you agree with the view presented by Sir R. A. Stubbs, quote, that it was a small local party run by young men with more money than brains, and that these men were, quote, generally regarded as half-wits and degenerates?
No, I wouldn't have said that.
No,
I have great respect for Stubbs. I mean, he was a much cleverer man than I was. But I wouldn't regard that at all as correct.
Yes,
There were some of them I met in whom I had very little confidence, but the leaders of them like, well, for instance, now, well, I knew Calvin Ardus de Silva.
Mm-hmm.
I had a great respect for him. And then certainly Henry Perrin and Philip Gunn-Warden. I met a lot of others who were rather... Well, they were immature.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have said anything more. I wouldn't agree with Stubbins at all.
No, what seems wrong about this view is that he says they were generally regarded. If he presented it as his view, he's justified. But when he uses the word generally regarded, yeah. He gives a rather...
Well, don't take my view. I mean, I don't take my view as being a general view.
No, but I recall, I think Mr. Tilney was surprised by this. And... well, certainly, looking at it in retrospect, and when looking at men such as Colvin Ardus and Enim and Philip Gunn-Warden, it's difficult to stand by such a view.
Oh, yes.
Do you know what... have you any inkling of the attitude taken by other politicians to this new group? Mr. Correa, for instance.
I don't remember talking over... the matter with him at all. One I remember, actually, this was a different matter at all. See, I ran the general election, you see, in 1935.
36. Oh, that was a special duty. I was wondering what it was.
And I was attached to the Attorney General Department and worked for the Langekorn, who was an extremely nice man. And we were told, I don't know, we'd come up against Colvin Ardus de Silva in somewhere, I've forgotten where it was. And the Langekorn said to me, I said, isn't he rather different? He said, no, he's an extremely nice chap and you'll find him very reasonable. And I did, I found him extremely reasonable. But that's the only opinion I got of the others.
Mm-hmm.
But I never knew what kind of... I know, actually, Senanaka didn't like
Gunn-Warden. Why, what sort of thing did he say?
We had a row with him and then had a fight. I don't know what he said. But just like, you see, there were two views. Senanaka was definitely of the view that he's very, very violent anti-communist, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he disliked any suggestion of any project which was any way related to communism.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking it over with Correa because wanted to introduce, I don't think it succeeded, it was in the Putnam district, a big collective farm.
Mm-hmm.
I got the idea actually from a book I read on the West Indies, which said it might be,
mm-hmm.
They said they were surprised that England, that our colonies had to introduce it. And I don't know, a man, an Engelgar, he's dead now, was especially put in charge of it, and I think he didn't put the drive and energy into it, which I hoped actually. Anyway, I was talking with Cora over this, you see, and he said that Senanaka wouldn't look at it at all. We wanted these small patches, you see. I mean, you were talking, you see, about Japan when you were coming up. Well, you see, the cultivation, as far as I gather, in Japan is very, very different, actually, to the cultivation in Ceylon.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got the, you see, I don't know Japan, except that I was a prisoner, but I always imagine from the lay of the country, they haven't got these big irrigation works which you've got in Ceylon,
which are especially
favorable for the development of big collective farms. But I know Senanaka said to me that Senanaka was all for peasant proprietors,
mm-hmm.
and small farms. And any idea of any suggestion of a collective farm would be an anathema to him.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that in his attitude to the Marxists and this sort of thing, he was rather too rigid and too much of the old school?
Senanaka?
Yes.
Yes, I would have said so.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, I mean, that's only my own view.
Yes, I see, yes.
Because I feel myself that, that some totalitarian state is absolutely essential if if these Asian countries are developed.
Yes. Well, so do I.
either right or left wing, I don't mind which it is, but I think something like that is imperative.
Regarding the LSSP, do you remember the Brace Girdle affair?
Well, that was what I was in England at the time.
Oh. So you don't really know much about it?
I don't know much about it.
It was rather hot issue.
My own view, it was a ridiculous issue.
Well, I don't know whether it was a wise move to try and get him deported.
It wasn't.
Who was responsible for that order? Wedderburn, I presume? Colonial Secretary? Yes.
Yes, I suppose it was Stubbs, actually. I suppose Stubbs made the order. He was the governor, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. I remember reading the account of it. That was a long time ago.
I was wondering whether any planters brought pressure to bear to have him deported.
Oh, I think so. I think there's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. And from statements made in the State Council, which are, of course, not all that reliable, I was wondering whether there was a feeling on the part of Stubbs and the planters that this chap was letting their side down, so to speak.
I think there probably was.
Mm-hmm.
I think there probably was.
Because, I mean, if a man like that had turned up in Britain, he would have been allowed to speak in Park Corner.
Right. Right. The planters were very apprehensive of any trouble in their labour. I mean, any suggestion of any unrest among them really made them terrified.
That's
putting it a bit strongly, but...
Do you think they tended to make mountains out of molehills?
Well, I should only say in that particular way.
In that particular way, mm-hmm. And if I may say something about the Mulloya incident, I think after the shooting on the estate, a commission was appointed, but there were going to be some prosecutions, and I think, if I recall correctly, the minister asked the IGP or someone, maybe it was not the IGP, but someone, to defer the prosecution till the commission reported. And he refused, I think. And this became a contretemps between the ministers and Sir Andrew Caldecott. And the ministers...
I can't remember the Mulloya incident, as a matter of fact.
Well,
I don't know, I can't remember. I know there was some trouble on the state, and the policeman shot.
This was the occasion when the ministers resigned in a body. Can you recall that?
Yes, but the ministers resigned in a body.
1941.
In 1941, but that was not to do with the Mulloya incident. That was to do, actually, with matters arising out of the Brace Girdle. You know, because they had a... I forgot exactly what the... That was due to the Banks incident.
Banks?
Yes.
Oh, what happened?
Well, you see...
He was IGP, wasn't he?
He was IGP, yes, but... I can't remember the sequence of events, but there was some inquiry
mm-hmm.
which was presided over by the Chief Justice, Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten what the issue of the inquiry was. Oh, it was to whether, how far Jayatilaka had been responsible, you see, in the matter of the issue of the warrant against Brace Girdle, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten exactly what it is, but I think, I'm not quite sure, but there was an inquiry, and the ministers took a strong exception to the findings of the inquiry,
mm-hmm.
and the result was they rely on the body.
I see, yes.
I'm not sure about this at all.
I mean,
some people know far more about it than I would.
I remember my father saying something about this in passing, and he said this inquiry, in effect, found that it was between Banks and Jayatilaka,
yes.
And they decided that that Jayatilaka was a liar, in effect.
That was what they did. I don't think he was a liar, in effect, his memory was so short that he forgot the name.
Well,
I mean, Jayatilaka was a nice sort of bloke, I mean.
He was not as strong as Senanaka was.
No, not a bit, no.
A weak man?
I shouldn't have said he was a weak man. I should say, actually, that he was able, by his personality, to bring opposing parties together who wouldn't have come together under Senarca.
Oh, I see.
I think that's possibly the case.
It was more genial.
More genial, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he commanded very much more confidence, I think, among the people. Senarca matured tremendously. He became really a wise statesman. The more one saw him, the more one liked him, and the more one appreciated him. He stayed with me in Singapore for about a fortnight, and I think got to know extremely well. And I also went to India with him, you see, on the, when we had this conference with the Indian government with regard to the relaxation of this immigration law.
That was in 1939?
No, that would be in 1940, I think.
40.
Was it? Would it be 1940? Yes, 1940.
And did you find this and it very hard to deal with the Indian government?
Yes.
What was it? What was your policy when you went? What did you want?
I wanted these all the restrictions to be abolished.
To allow them to go up and down?
Up and down, yeah.
And what was the Indian government's standpoint?
The Indian government allowed it all. I remember saying, and of course there were a lot of politicians in Ceylon, Indians like F.X. Blyas Pereira and people like that who were opposed to it, who wanted these restrictions enforced. Because they felt actually that the Indians were not being given their proper status in Ceylon. And I remember saying actually to I.X. Pereira, who was quite a nice chap, a rather narrow-minded man, but he was a very strong protagonist of the Indian community in Ceylon. I said to him, surely these people in India are suffering terribly, can't you? As a result of this ban on immigration. He said, they must suffer for Mother India. I remember that remark.
They must suffer for Mother India?
Yeah.
I see. Weren't some of the Sinhalese politicians for restrictions on the ground that these Indians were swamped in Ceylon?
I think they were, but they didn't sort of realize, actually. They wouldn't accept, you see, they wouldn't accept at all the recommendations of the Jackson Commission or the findings of the Jackson Commission. I remember when we had this conference in India, you see, I attended it. I wasn't a member of it. I was merely an observer. Mm-hmm. There was Senanayake, Huxham, Corrier, and Bandranayake. I had Bandranayake on the one side. And there was a man called Bajpai. I don't know whether you've heard of him.
No.
He was Nehru's right-hand man until he died. And there was a fellow called Ramasam Mudle or someone like that. Anyway, they were extremely able chaps. I think there were one or two of them. You'll turn to them when not. But I remember suddenly one of them said that Ramasam Mudle, who was extremely able chap, looked in surprise, that you don't accept the findings of the Jackson Commission. And they all said, including Huxham, who knew nothing about it, said we don't accept either the findings or the facts. They looked at
What sort of man was Huxham?
Well, he was a clever man. Mm-hmm. But I never thought that he really
crossed.
No, I don't really know very much about him, but the impression I got was that he was extremely able. He didn't put forward his own financial views with regard to the state of the colony. But on the other hand, when the budget was passed, he was prepared to place restrictions through the Treasury on expenditure, which was never contemplated in the budget.
Very Treasury-minded, then.
Very Treasury-minded. They regarded the Treasury as occupying the same position in Ceylon which it used to occupy in this country.
This would have made him rather unpopular with the politicians.
No, he was popular with politicians.
He was.
I don't think they realized what he was doing.
I see. What did you think of a young SWRB at that stage?
Oh, I feel I didn't like him.
Well, my father said that he thought he was a careerist.
Well, I always think of Bandranayake in this sort of way. In one of the tales of Kipling's, the viceroy had a very doctrinaire secretary. He used to be very worried because the viceroy had no policy. And the viceroy said, "The policy is the blackmail levied on a fool by the unforeseen." Well, that seems to be typical of Bandranayake's attitude. He had no policy, but he regarded himself as clever enough to meet any circumstances which he might arise.
Oh, I see.
He had no basic policy.
Opportunist, in other words.
Opportunist.
Mm-hmm. Was he communal-minded at that stage, too?
Yes. I remember, in fact, talking to this fellow, Rajanagar, from I don't know who kind of conference.
I have heard of him.
He was very clever, then. He was my deputy, you must tell him how. And he was very worried about Bandranayake's appeal, actually, to the racial element in Ceylon politics.
Mm-hmm.
He was very, very worried about it.
Well, he was not the first, of course. I think in 1931, Gunasinghe, when he was beginning to lose his hold on the trade unions, brought this Indian issue up around the early 1930s.
Yes, he was actually pro-Indian at one time.
At one time. And then I think it changed. If I may take that issue up and go back to the 1920s when you were in the Secretariat, was much notice taken of Gunasinghe then?
No. They rather regarded him as one. When I came across him, I was in the customs for 4 years.
Yes.
There was a strike then.
Yes.
Didn't and I saw a little of him then.
Was he an opportunist and rather unreasonable or otherwise?
Well, I thought him unreasonable then, but looking back on it, I don't think he was unreasonable.
Oh, I see.
I think a lot of these people, in fact, they were sincere. It was probably perhaps 75% sincerity and 25% personal,
yes.
Ambition.
Well, yes.
It is with many people. I mean, I think it's pretty well, if you put that element in front of a British politician, I think he'd be rather flattering to
them. Well, I come across references to him, to Gunasinghe, you know, agitator and all that, almost as if in the same terms as McCarthy used the word red in America.
When I was, I had very little to do with him, actually, as when I was in the Labour Department. The little I had to do with him, I found him extremely reasonable.
Mm-hmm. But
he sobered a great deal, in that way.
He sobered, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't mean alcoholically.
No, I know what you mean. But it is strange that in this respect, somewhere on the late 1920s, someone in the Secretariat somewhere wrote, "I don't think Mr. Gunasinghe is as black as he is painted out to be." So this
I can't remember that. I probably didn't. I was very junior in the Secretariat. I don't think actually he, when I was in the Secretariat, I don't think he was mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
See, I went in the customs early in January 1924,
mm-hmm.
and I was there until well into halfway through 1928, and that was when he was coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when he was backing the Indians.
I see. And what was the government policy towards the trade unions in the 1920s? Well, embryonic trade unions.
I couldn't say, as a matter of fact. I wasn't very much, I was out of touch with them then.
Yes, you were in the customs.
I was in the customs, and I don't know exactly what the view would be then. But I should have thought that they were, at that time, you know, the Sinhalese politicians, the Ceylonese politicians were of a very limited class, weren't they?
Yes.
And they would rather, we regarded Gunasinghe as being very much an upstart.
Oh, they did?
I should think so, but yes. I don't know.
That's the feeling I've got too. I was wondering if there was any caste feeling on this.
I think very likely.
Mm-hmm. And So they, would you say that they disliked him intensely? Your impression?
I shouldn't have said it got so far, intense dislike.
But just as an outsider.
An outsider, that's mm-hmm. all. I shouldn't think they regarded Sarah enough to be to dislike him.
Do you recall the labor legislation in 1929?
I was away in England.
Oh, I see. Because I think this labor law was disallowed in England, but it was met by the labor government. And
what was that?
That was a trade union law. And Sidney Webb, Lord Parsfield, was Secretary of State for the colonies. Mm. And it was disallowed.
See, I was in the education department for 3 years, you see. When I suppose it was in 1929 to 1930.